willkommen zum NMA Fireside Chat, dem Podcast des Next Media Accelerator. Dieses Mal auf Englisch. Der Managing Partner Nico Lummer hat Professor Rasmus Kleis-Nielsen vom Reuters-Institut zu Gast. Aber hört selbst. Viel Spaß.
Hi, my name is Nico Lummer and this is the latest edition of the NMA Fireside Chat. I'm really happy that we have Rasmus Nielsen here today to talk about media innovation and the role our industry will be taking in the next couple of years. Rasmus is probably one of the best-known scholars on the subject of media studies. And Rasmus, could you tell us a little bit about what you're doing right now, what the focus of your work is?
Sure. Thanks for having me. So I'm director of the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism and professor of political communication at the University of Oxford. And what we do at the Institute is that we try to explore the future of journalism worldwide. We do that with mid-career journalists who come and spend time with us in Oxford. They come from all over the world, and normally we have about 20 journalists from about as many different countries with us. We do it through leadership development programs where we work in private, off-the-record settings with editors and news media executives to help them sort of think through the issues that they face and learn from their peers as well as from research that we put in front of them and speakers that we bring in. And then we do research where we try to bring the standards of contemporary social science in terms of evidence, in terms of rigor, in terms of precision, to bear on some of the big issues that face journalists and news media across the world today, in the belief that the same way that journalists can help citizens make better decisions, not tell them what to do, but provide a basis in which they can make their own decisions, perhaps we as researchers can help provide insight and analysis and evidence that can help journalists and news media across the world make their own decisions about how they want to move towards the future that they want.
So when you talk to those journalists and or people from media organizations, what's like the recurring theme that you're having there? It's probably, you know, coming from print and getting to digital, but it's also probably about audiences evolving and using other media outlets than they used before, right?
I think there is determination. I think there is fear. And I think there is frustration, but also hope. I think there is determination in the sense that, you know, this has been a rough 25 years for journalism and for news media and in many parts of the world where for a long period of time, it was we now know in retrospect, a very stable and quite lucrative industry and profession. And now that stability is gone and a lot of the revenue is gone as well. The people who are carrying on are really committed to making that work and to finding ways ahead. And they know that it's not easy. And a lot of them have, you know, fought in the trenches for some time and understand that there are no easy solutions, but that what journalists do matters and it's worth fighting to make that work. I think there is fear, and some of that fear is, you know, just the fact that, you know, we face a situation in which in much of the world there is a war being waged on journalism by powerful people who don't like to be held to account or have people sort of independently reporting on what they're doing. We see the emergence of very powerful, large technology companies that exercise incredible power over free expression and also play a dominant role in some parts of the marketplace. That really challenge the companies that employ many journalists and people understandably are sometimes afraid of that power and that prominence. And sometimes I think there is also just the fear of change, which again is a completely human reaction. And I would say that, you know, that's one that academics can sometimes feel as well. You know, we are not always necessarily all that adaptive or willing to change, even if the world is changing around us, but sort of a fear of change and sometimes a preference of what is known, even if, as Dean Baquet sometimes said, I think the challenge is to distinguish between what we do because it's mission and what we do because it's habit. And I think that leads to the sort of frustration point. You know, I've written elsewhere about how I think we can sort of recognizing a lot of complexity and variation and a lot of people in the middle, but sort of crudely put, distinguish between what I think of as sort of a rear guard of people who are mostly interested in sort of defending and restoring what they see as the sort of glorious golden past of journalism, and then what I think of as a vanguard of people who are less interested in what journalism was and more interested in what they believe journalism should be in the future. As a profession and as a business and a way of doing something valuable in the world. And I think that tension between those two groups around matters editorial and matters of sort of business and strategy and technology, but also over matters like the reckoning over diversity and how we historically and in the present have covered different groups in society, is generating a lot of frustration and friction inside the profession and the industry. And then finally, I'd say I think we see a lot of hope also. It seems perhaps perverse to say about a year into a global pandemic that has, you know, really put a lot of extra pressure on journalists in terms of their workload and the mental health, as well as in the business of the companies that employ them, and as well as the horrible sort of human toll of the pandemic and the lockdown in many countries. But I do think in some ways we are in a more hopeful place now than we were just a few years ago, in the sense that we, I think, have sort of seen how there are more and more examples of both legacy media organizations and new entrants who are building sustainable businesses around distinct value-added journalism in a digital space. I think we are seeing a lot of really impressive innovation in terms of sort of open source intelligence and collaboration and other forms of sort of new journalistic practices. And I think we've also seen a sort of a reminder during the pandemic that even in the world in which many people are quite distrusting of journalism, not that impressed with journalism, don't really think it's all that valuable or important, that even many of these people who may hold a pretty dim view of much of journalism in the news, it's been sort of a reminder during the pandemic that, you know, it's kind of a good idea to have a professionals, independent professionals who hold power to account and keep an eye on people who are making important decisions. And it's kind of important that we all have access to independent sources of information that aren't beholden to sort of governments or individual corporate interests, but, you know, effectively are trying to seek truth and report it and make an honest living while doing it. So I think in some ways, while it's obviously a very challenging moment, that, you know, we're also seeing some hope that there are ways ahead, and that, you know, with all its terrible negative impact, the pandemic has also in some ways, I think, reminded some of the public of the value of journalism.
Yeah, but, you know, I think at the same time, what we've also seen is that lots of media organizations have really struggled with, you know, the shift from, you know, a print focus to a digital focus, you know, a shift from a newsroom where everybody's sitting there all day long writing to a newsroom that's, you know, basically at home. And, you know, you have a different way to communicate inside the newsroom. And I think a lot of organizations are hoping that this period will be over so that they can revert back to what they consider normal.
Well, I mean, I think normal is gone. And, you know, I have to say that in light of the sort of the scale and scope of change that, you know, has happened in recent years and is happening now and arguably has been accelerated by the pandemic in terms of the move to a more digital, mobile and platform dominated media environment, you know, business as usual is suicidal. You know, and I say that, you know, from the point of view of sort of journalism as a profession and the long-term sustainability of individual news brands. And I think we need to be clear that this is in part some of the sort of frustration that I spoke about earlier that exists inside the industry and the profession is that, look, you know, we all want to do what's right, but we also need to be realistic that sometimes people have objectively different interests. And, you know, there are some journalists who could quite reasonably be thinking to themselves, look, you know, I'm near the end of my career. It's going to last my time out. I'm just going to hold on for dear life and do what I'm good at. And then someone else has to figure out the future. You know, I'm not blaming people who might think that quietly in their hearts of hearts. I'm just observing that that is not going to work for everybody else who's younger than them, because it might last some people's time out, but it's not a long-term sustainable strategy to sort of live in the past. And we also need to recognize similarly with owners that, you know, there are paths ahead, but those paths are not easy. And many of those paths are less profitable and lucrative than what the media industry in some countries used to be like in the past. And again, I mean, there will be owners, or for that matter, shareholders, who might be thinking, you know what, I'm going to leave it to others to do the difficult work of figuring out what sustainable, independent digital journalism looks like. And I'm just going to manage decline and slowly sort of asset strip the company that I have and run it for its cash flow. And then when it's gone, it's gone. And someone else has to figure out the future. You know, these are entirely rational positions. And I think we have to recognize that there are some who will take that path. And then those journalists and those media executives and those investors and owners who are genuinely focused on the future just have to not let themselves be distracted by the fact that others are making other choices. And those who care about the future of journalism, I think, need to sort of maintain that broad distinction between the understandable and legitimate sort of practices of carrying on and serving a shrinking and aging audience. That's entirely legitimate and appropriate, but not confusing that with what it'll take to make sure that there are distinct, digital, valuable, and sustainable forms of journalism that works longer term.
How do you see the role of big platforms like, obviously, Facebook, Google, but, you know, Snap, TikTok, Insta, and all those in the future, you know, as they draw more and more eyeballs, more and more attention, and basically, you know, play a large role in the distribution of news information?
I mean, first of all, of course, there are a tremendous challenge to the historic business model of news. Sort of crudely put, it used to be the case that news publishers had high market power over advertisers, in large part because as individual media users, you know, we had low choice. And we have moved from that environment to a world in which I, as a media user, have high choice when it comes to news sources. And as a consequence, news publishers have low market power over advertisers. And the platforms essentially have completely changed the way in which digital advertising in particular works. I mean, if the old model of offline publishing was that what a publisher did was to integrate content and advertising and put that in front of an audience, what the platforms are doing by providing these services and products that many of us find so compelling as end users is that they're integrating the audience, our time and attention, with the advertising. And then content providers can put their content in front of people on those platforms. And I think what we're seeing is that news publishers who, I mean, crudely put, were used to be companies who thought they were in the content business, but really were in the advertising business, are increasingly now waking up to the fact that they really are in the content business. And the content business, in an incredibly competitive digital marketplace, is much, much tougher than the sort of more stable environment where news publishers were often kings of the hill and dominated some kinds of advertising, at least at the local level, and had quite stable and sort of regionalized market structures with limited competition. And in this new digital media environment, the platforms are winning the battle for attention from us as end users. They are attracting a lot of different third-party complementers. Publishers are only one of those kinds of third-party complementers. They're collecting an awful lot of data in the process. And off the back of all of that, they can offer advertisers very high reach, very precise targeting, and very low prices. And when we look at how advertisers are spending their money and how audiences are spending their time, even if they have many reservations about the power of these companies, they also seem to be quite drawn to what they have to offer. So this is, of course, a very serious challenge to the business of news. And more broadly, the way in which the companies then allocate attention through ranking algorithms and the like can sometimes have, quite unpredictable and sometimes quite negative consequences in terms of what gets surfaced, whether it's based on scores of authority, the way that search works, or on engagement as much social works. You know, we've seen that, for example, on Facebook, there seems to be evidence that sort of quite polarizing and partisan content, whether from established media or various sort of more alternative sources, sometimes misinformation providers, can do quite well, which is quite different from the way in which the open web has worked, or for that matter, search, or for that matter, television and print. So the rise of the platforms is a tremendous challenge to the business of news. It's a tremendous challenge in terms of how we think about the distribution of news, how we get news in front of the people, the audience, that ultimately are the arbiters of its value and that we need to reach to create both public and commercial value. At the same time, of course, we also need to recognize that, publishers have engaged with these platforms even as they also knew that they were competitors for both attention and advertising, because they also offer very real opportunities for reaching people who do not come directly to news sites or apps. And while I can't recall having met any publishers really who have no reservations about the platforms, and quite a lot of them have quite a lot of different reservations about the platforms and unease about their power and prominence of the biggest ones, it's also the case that almost every publisher very actively works with search engine optimization, with social media investment, social media optimization, often with advertising and social media and elsewhere, because they see a return on investment, because they know and see and value every day the fact that these platforms, even as they compete with them for attention and advertising, also can help them reach people that they want to reach and need to reach, and that they have few other ways of reaching. Now, it's clear that there are some parts of the platform economy that are very consolidated, that where there's some very big incumbents who are very entrenched and are, you know, play a very large role, whether it's the role of Facebook in social, the role of YouTube and Google in video sharing and search, the role of Amazon in e-commerce, and of course Apple in parts of the App Store economy and handset and other connected devices economy. So there are some very big incumbents that we are seeing quite a lot of sort of critical and regulatory scrutiny of, and some attempts to regulate in various ways. But I think it's important, as you say, to recognize that, you know, while the big platforms are very big and very important, they're not the only platforms. And I think publishers are sometimes losing sight of the fact that there are a growing number of other smaller platforms. And the truth of the matter is that we're sort of, as an industry, largely engaging with them on the same way that we've engaged with the older platforms and bigger platforms for quite a long time, in that they come to us effectively and offer terms of trade that are, if you give us access to content, we will give you access to reach, and it's up to you to figure out the monetization because we will control the user experience at the interface, because they are our users. You're welcome to join, but it's up to you, and you have to figure out your own business model. Now, this is something that publishers have often had a difficult time figuring out with previous platforms. And yet here we are in 2021, and publishers are engaging on very similar terms with TikTok, with Snapchat, with Telegram, with Line, launching things on WhatsApp and elsewhere. And I think it sort of illustrates that, you know, the platforms are here to stay, the big ones, but also this growing number of other platforms that even in the situation which there is more and more public scrutiny and critical discussion around the way in which the platforms work in our societies, it's still the case that users are overwhelmingly flocking to them, not just the big ones, but also new ones. And publishers may not like that, but we are seeing that the vast majority of publishers are actively looking for ways in which they can make the most of this situation, even as they also have all sorts of reservations about what it means for them and what it means for journalism.
But that also means that the old traditional way we look at journalism as also being the gatekeepers who, you know, control what gets out there, have lost some of their distribution power, because the platforms at least share some of the control of, you know, what gets in front of an audience. I mean, the publisher can publish whatever they want, obviously, but it's then the algorithm that starts ranking stuff and starts, you know, giving this to an audience. So there's some power lost on the publisher side. But what does that make, you know, in turn, or what does that mean in turn for our society? Because, you know, the way we traditionally perceive journalism was, you know, somebody checked it, ideally, and sometimes I even knew kind of like their political positioning, roughly, so I could, you know, understand more about the context. And now this just gets put in front of me by some algorithm. What does that mean in terms of, you know, media literacy, but also in terms of, you know, what kind of news get out there to
sure.
the individual user?
I think that's a really important illustration of how our media environments are changing. I think there are a couple of different ways of sort of thinking about that very big and complex phenomenon. I mean, one is, you know, to recognize the shift from what I would think of as sort of direct discovery to more distributed discovery. So direct discovery is a situation in which the publisher behind a piece of content essentially controls both the content and the channel through which it reach a member of the public, which of course is how print and broadcast work, and to some extent how individual news sites work if we go direct to them or to apps. From that environment of direct discovery to one in which distributed discovery plays a much larger role, where the publisher still, you know, control the creation of the content of what carries their imprimatur and exists under their brand and their domain, but the channels through which people arrive at it and engage with it are often through these different platform intermediaries and are often in large part shaped by all sorts of other considerations. From the users, you know, what are you searching for? What is it that you seek on social? Who do you follow? Who do you like? And so on and so forth. But of course, also the business interests and self-interest of the platform in question. So the separation, if you will, of control over channels and content is a defining feature of where we are. Now, that's true that means that news publishers have lost some of the gatekeeping power that they held in an offline environment. Scholars like to distinguish between what Jane Singer has called sort of first order gatekeeping, which is the power to sort of determine, you know, what we think of as news and recognize as journalism. And this power still is largely held by journalists working at news organizations. The public still sees journalism and news as distinct from just sort of stuff on the internet, just sort of content in the aggregate. So that sort of first order gatekeeping power still exists, even though, of course, it's often diffused amongst more different news media than it was in the past, and hence the power of individual brands may be diminished, even if the institution of the news still has very considerable gatekeeping power over this sort of first level. But of course, then there is a second order of gatekeeping power, which is the power over distribution, and there the power of news media is much diminished, as platforms and other entities and third parties play a much, much larger role in many different ways, most visibly Google's search engine and Facebook's various social and media and messaging platforms, but also just the way in which things will circulate amongst individuals, forwarding things by email in private groups and then messaging applications and the like, various forms of peer-to-peer distribution. Now, what does this mean? Well, I mean, I think it's important to recognize that this is one of those things that has tremendously sort of ambiguous consequences, in the sense that it's very clear that for those who really value journalism as it was practiced historically and the news media and what they stood for, there is a sense of real loss here. And this sort of feeds into various narratives of decline. And we get this sort of sense that there was sort of a golden age, and now we live in this sort of world that's driven by, you know, popular opinion and platform business models. But I think it's just really worth recognizing that, you know, not everyone thought of that as a golden age. And the people who thought of it as a golden age often happened to be the people who were the gatekeepers, the journalists and the news publishers who had a lot of power and made a lot of money. And it's not at all obvious that everybody else thought of that as such a golden age. And the same gatekeeping power that news organizations also exercised editorially to try to create credible, authoritative, and trustworthy content also often produced journalism that I think, frankly, we need to recognize that people would see as being racist, as being sexist, as being homophobic, as being classist, as being pro-establishment, as being, you know, very actively reinforcing and amplifying stereotypes against marginalized communities of various sorts. And what we see in a digital media environment is that, you know, everyone can speak. That doesn't mean that everyone will get hurt. That often depends quite a lot on the different sort of platform ranking algorithms. But everyone can speak. And that is being used by all sorts of groups who often have grievances towards established media. Some of those grievances I may not have a lot of sympathy for myself. I mean, I think the sort of cult of victimhood among sort of older white men in America doesn't quite reflect the facts on the ground. But there are other groups who I think have far more legitimate grievances and who I think are quite rightly very critical of how the news media and the journalistic profession historically exercise its gatekeeping power. So it's very true that digital media and social media were used in sort of very, from my personal point of view, very sort of retrograde political mobilizations like the Capitol Hill riot in January and various forms of sort of, you know, white pride, nationalism and domestic terrorism and the like. But look, I mean, we also need to recognize that social media and digital media have been absolutely integral to Me Too. It's been absolutely integral to Black Lives Matter. It's been absolutely integral to Fridays for the Future and the climate mobilization, and that many of the individuals involved in Me Too, Black Lives Matter, or the climate emergency mobilization would say, you know what, journalists ignored the issues that we are focused on for decades, for years and years and years, and they might be quite happy that the gatekeeping power of journalism and news media is much reduced.
Yeah, I see that as well. But at the same time, what I don't see, at least, you know, not at a scale that, you know, it really grasps my attention, is new alternative media outlets that are popping up because, you know, they see that there's, you know, some space in the market where they could fit in. I see that, you know, people mobilize on those topics. But the next, from my perspective, logical step would be to establish a new media outlet and, you know, use that as a base. Do you see that? Because I don't.
Well, I mean, I think there are quite a lot of new media outlets that are propping up. Some of them are sort of newish in that they have sort of 10 years or more behind them, and others are newer than that. And they in Europe would include, you know, El Diario in Spain, Mediapart in France, The Correspondent in the Netherlands, Zetland in Denmark, Republic Magazine in Switzerland, Tortoise in the UK. I mean, there are quite a lot of these, Denik N in Slovakia, and there are many more beyond. So I think there are new entrants that are appearing and who are establishing themselves as distinct, as creating valuable quality journalism that people engage with, that people often are willing to pay for or sign up as members of, and that are really valuable additions to the media environment and very impressive editorially as well as businesses. But on your broader point, I mean, I think it's worth just sort of recognizing that I think what journalists and news people often look for are sort of new forms of journalism and new forms of news media. But, you know, that reflects a sort of, you know, what you see depends on where you sit. I don't think that Greta Thunberg set out to create a new version of Dagens Nyheter. You know, she set out to counter climate change. And she and others involved in that movement are not particularly interested in seeking truth and reporting it, or building up a business. They're interested in changing the world. And in some ways, that's quite different from, you know, what journalists, you know, do and think of themselves as being sort of impartial and committed to the idea of seeking truth and reporting it, and often seeking to ensure their editorial autonomy and independence in part through a independent, sustainable private business. But again, while what these movements, whether it's Me Too, Black Lives Matters, Fridays for the Future, or again, some of these darker currents of sort of alt-right and white nationalist and domestic terrorists of various sorts, what they do, I think, while quite different from the journalism we had recently, is perhaps less different from quite a lot of journalism historically, in the sense that one of the origins of journalism was political reform movements to expand franchise and citizenship. It was the suffragettes movement for women's right to vote. It was the labor movement for organized workers' rights. It was the abolitionist movement in the United States, the civil rights movement, and the African-American press in the United States. It was anti-colonial movements and movements of national liberation around the world. And a lot of those news media that we now treasure and value and see as bastions of impartial news reporting are that, but were also originally parts of political movements, whether it's the Hindu in Chennai or, you know, The Economist, for that matter, in the UK, which is not exactly a campaigning organization these days, but of course has its origins as part of a movement for social change. So, you know, we need to sort of recognize that journalism and news can take many forms, and that information and sort of communication for social change takes many forms, and that there are people who are using media for purposes that are very different from those that journalists use them for, even though they have some historic commonalities. And if we want to see future forms of journalism that reflect our values, then it's up to us to create them. We can't expect, you know, Greta Thunberg, for all her considerable qualities, to both save the planet and save journalism. You know, maybe it should be up to journalists to do the second part, and then she can get on with saving the planet.
Yeah, that sounds like a good plan. What do you make of the current trend, at least in the U.S., that lots of well-known journalists take the audience with them and move to Substack, and then directly try to monetize the audience with a small monthly subscription fee?
I mean, it's I think it's another interesting example of how, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but sometimes it rhymes. I forget who originally coined that that phrase. Again, I mean, I think we have become a sort of a little bit transfixed and sort of a little bit held captive by a very particular picture of what we think journalism and news media ought to look like, which is sort of the large bureaucratic news organization with a big fancy headquarters, with a large newsroom, hundreds of employees, you know, a reception with a secretary, you know, plush leather chairs for the board on the top floor, with a glass, you know, a facade looking over the city. And there is a lot going for that model. I mean, there is a value in having powerful institutions who have the clout to really throw a reporting resource at covering a story, who can stand up to legal threats of intimidation and the like, and have a considerable audience that that politicians and others will find it hard to ignore systematically. There are real values to these sort of large and resource-rich organizations. But again, I mean, I think what we're seeing with Substack specifically, and more broadly with the sort of the rise of sort of the individual voice, sort of so-called influencers as a sort of a term for it, and then in turn sort of funded through a variety of different streams of revenue, whether it's Substack subscriptions or, you know, people who are, you know, making their living from being sort of consultants and moderating debates and serving as at events and whatnot, and writing freelance off the back of a profile that they build in part through their individual activities on social media. In some ways, I think it's a reemergence of the pamphleteers that, again, were very central to what, you know, what journalism looked like in the 18th and 19th century, for example. I mean, you know, we sometimes, I think, have sort of take for granted what we grew up with a little bit. And, you know, in my case, that means I grew up with a situation in which, you know, Denmark, my native country, you know, would have I don't know, like 40 or 50 different newspapers across the country, and then, you know, half a dozen national newspapers. But, you know, in my parents' generation and my grandparents' generation, Denmark had 400 newspapers because every political party had their own newspaper in every town, right? And before that, you know, in an earlier stage in history, there'd be lots and lots of different pamphlets that were often quite carried by a single charismatic editor who sort of represented this and who often had sort of, I think, what we today would consider quite a complex relationship with some, you know, sponsorship, some advertising, some side businesses, maybe some political connections and the like. And it's very different from the journalism that we associate with sort of the big commercial for-profit newspaper of the late 20th century. And of course, there are many different possible problems with this and many real sort of drawbacks to it. But it also has some virtues that different individuals can build a sustainable base for expressing their views and sometimes doing it more freely than they felt they could in the large bureaucratic organization.
How do you see the development with local and regional papers? I mean, we see in the U.S. Markets where they're underserved, where newspapers are disappearing. Then sometimes digital formats come in, sometimes not. We see in the UK endeavors like Bristol Cable, which I find very interesting. And in Germany, we have a debate that, you know, because of minimum wage, it's not feasible anymore to distribute paper to those towns. And then the newspaper organizations argue that there will be white spots. Well, I think there's the internet, radio, TV. I don't think they will be underserved if a local newspaper is not delivered on paper. What do you make out of all this? Because I think that's something that's rapidly accelerating at the moment.
I mean, I'm very optimistic about the future of journalism, crudely put, for people like me who are affluent, who are have high levels of formal education, who are very interested in the news and who are willing to pay for it. I live in a sort of a dreamland of abundant, high quality, easily accessible quality content tailored to the interests and prejudices of people like me. So I'm going to be fine, and I'm going to be fine for the foreseeable future, and people like me in different countries around the world are going to be fine as well. I think the two biggest challenges we face are, on the one hand, it's growing information inequality as it becomes less and less commercially attractive and sustainable to produce news for a more popular audience of people with more limited levels of formal education, lower levels of income, often less interested in news and less willing to pay for it. Essentially the part of the population that the popular papers in Europe historically catered to, that is a much less lucrative. And it's further compounded then by how in many countries around the world, the people who are least well off are also marginalized in other ways, and whether that's because of their ethnicity and race or their religion or in other ways, so sort of intersectional issues. That means that the provision of news that speaks to and from the point of view of less privileged people in society is something that worries me, and whether those parts of the public will feel that they are represented, that they are respected, and that they are reflected in the news, that really worries me. So inequality, I think, is a real issue. And the other big issue, I think, is local, which you seize on. And, you know, and I say this sort of wanting to be convinced otherwise, and I have, you know, people I tremendously respect who do local newspaper journalism who think I'm wrong, and I hope that they are right and that I am wrong. But I am worried about, you know, whether there are sustainable models that can be sort of evolved from local newspapers, because it seems to me that the sort of cost structure and assumptions that goes into, you know, running a sort of a small or mid-sized town newspaper as if it was essentially a smaller version of the New York Times, you know, that could work in an offline media environment where that paper had a near monopoly on local advertising, and where people picked it up in part for its news, but also for many other reasons, to get weather, to get movie listings, to get, you know, events in the community, to get classifieds and all sorts of other things from this community institution that was editorial, but also many other things. But of course, in the digital media environment, most of us can get almost everything that that local newspaper bundle gave us in other ways, more efficiently and often for free and often more compellingly through social media groups, through messaging applications, through search, through the websites of local authorities and local businesses and the like. And most of us are not paying for local news. And frankly, we are often not even paying attention to it. When we look at the online space, of course, the problem is not whether there is access to local news, it is whether people access it. So in the United States a couple of years ago, a very good researcher, Matthew Hindman, looked at the overall share of attention paid to news in the United States of all time spent online. All news combined was just 3%. Just 3% of the time that people spend online. But even more strikingly, perhaps, only 0.5% of time spent online was spent with local media. And this is in the United States, a very large country with a long tradition of very local and regional media markets, not a national media market. But even there, news consumption was a tiny part of online attention, and most of it went to large national brands. So I think local is going to be super challenging. And I really hope that local newspapers can find ways ahead. And I think some of them can if they can sort of leave behind the commercial expectations and cost structure and mindset of this sort of, we're a smaller version of the New York Times, and really sort of rethink themselves as local community institutions on a much leaner base and with a much clearer editorial focus. And I think we are seeing some encouraging examples of that. You mentioned the Bristol Cable in the UK. The Lincolnite is another example of that. But I think we have to recognize this is very challenging. And it's one of the areas where I think there's clearest risk of market failure of sort of for-profit provision of journalism. And of course, in many parts of the world and in poor parts of even rich countries, there's long been a market failure for local journalism in that, more affluent communities often had relatively good local news provision, but poorer parts of even rich countries had little. And in many, medium and low income countries, there was never much local journalism to begin with. So I think that's a super challenging part of the environment.
Okay. Thank you, Rasmus, for your time. This has been really an interesting quick excursion on the current status of news media. Wonderful. Thanks for having us. And, I'd like to continue this conversation at some other time.
Thanks, Nico. Let me just end by saying that, the challenges I said, I think, are very real around local and around underprivileged communities and marginalized communities. But I would also say, as I think I mentioned along the way, that in some ways, I think we can be more optimistic now than we could a few years ago, in the sense that we are seeing more and more examples of both legacy organizations and new entrants who do distinct, valuable digital journalism, who are making it work as a business, and who are finding ways ahead. And that was less obvious a few years ago. In that sense, I think we have reasons to be cautious optimists, even though the challenges are very real.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Nico.
Das war der NMA Fireside Chat. Wenn es euch gefallen hat, dann lasst doch ein Like, Subscribe oder ein Share da. Wir freuen uns auch über eure Reviews auf Apple Podcasts. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören und bis zum nächsten Mal bei Fireside Chat.